From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, it's been a year since Dr. Mark Schlissel was installed as president of the University of Michigan. We get his take on the challenges of higher education at Michigan.
I think we cannot achieve the level of excellence in education and research we aspire to without being far more diverse than we are.
Plus, why we can't seem to shake the belief the state lottery should be paying for our schools.
People see all that money being spent and assume that that money is enough to fund a good chunk of, you know, what we spend on students.
And we look at the history of owning dogs in Detroit and those packs of dogs prowling the streets in the 1800s.
It was a serious problem. It was not just in Detroit. It was across the country.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel is heading into year two on the job. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we'll get his take on the challenges of higher education at Michigan. But first, after more than 2 weeks of asking questions, examining documents, listening to audio tapes, an internal State House report is out. The investigation looked into allegations of misconduct by Representatives Todd Corser and Cindy Gamrat. Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are co-hosts of It's Just Politics here on Michigan Radio. Rick, let's start with you. What was the scope of the House investigation and who conducted it?
The investigation was conducted by the nonpartisan House business manager, Tim Bolin. And the subject of the inquiry was into whether or not, I guess essentially, Representatives Corser and Gamrat had shamed the House, behaved irresponsibly in terms of what they did, and then whether or not public resources were misused, their offices, their computers, their staff people's time and efforts. And what the report found was that they were, in fact, culpable for behaving deceitfully and then also, you know, using those resources to try and cover up the deceit in some respects in some, you know, very, very over the top fashions, like, you know, the now infamous false flag email where Todd Corser wanted to start circulating awful rumors about his own behavior in order to sort of, you know, make what was really going on seem tame in comparison.
And Zoe, so the conclusions certainly are not flattering for the representatives, starting with the very first one that Corser and Gamrat, quote, are not credible witnesses, a nice way to say they lie?
Well, yes, and basically saying that anything that they've said, some of them privately and some of them to the public, in apologies even, a press conference that Representative Gamrat held, that she was even found to be lying during this. I mean, I think the three Ds are what a lot of reporters and folks in Lansing are focusing on, and that is this quote from the report, which is deceptive, deceitful, and outright dishonest conduct. Not something you want to be labeled as two folks that get voted into office by constituents.
And Rick, I know that...
Yeah, I'd say this is pretty damaging to, you know, Representative Gamrat in particular, because she's really been trying to rehabilitate herself in the eyes of her fellow House members, the Republican caucus, and the public, her constituents. And what this report says is that a lot of the things that she said in that effort have been untruthful.
Yes, and one of the things, I mean, there's one thing to have these words, right, about being deceitful. There's another issue, Cindy, that I think you're bringing up, and this is the idea that not only are they liars, but they did what it sounds like are some illegal activities.
And apart from the affair, because we see business purposes, for instance, having staff.
Business purposes. One of the biggest issues, which actually, I believe, Rick, tell me if I'm wrong, is either a misdemeanor or a felony, but this is against the Michigan campaign Finance Act. And this is this idea that some of their staffers who are being paid by state taxpayer money, right? These are staffers that basically work for Michigan, i.e. though they work for Corser or Gamrat, were taking information from constituents. Let's say a constituent, and I'm being hypothetical here, but I'm trying to give an example of what this could look like, that someone could call because there was a tax issue.
Okay.
A reason that you would want to call a state rep. Hey, I don't think this is fair. I want to know more about this. They leave their name. They leave their email. They leave their address and phone number. And what it sounds like this report is saying is then these staffers were made to take that personal information and use it then in a political database, something that they're not allowed to do. And also that some of these staffers were actually being asked to help on campaigns. So Corser mm-hmm. possibly thinking about running for Congress in Candace Miller's seat, Gamrat thinking about running for Republican National Committee woman from Michigan. And this is against the Michigan campaign finance.
And also
well,
to
may
further
be.
Corser's
better...
law office, right? To help his own business, his own private business.
Indeed.
Well, that was a separate allegation that one of his staffers was placing online ads for his law business. Mm-hmm. But back to this issue of staffers, if they're going to push that particular one hard, they'd better be careful, because staffers in these offices serve a multitude of functions, mm-hmm. that they are policy advisors, they are legislative advisors, they work on constituent relations. They are also, though, political advisors. Very often, they have kind of second jobs, making sure that campaign finance statements are filed and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. And they can even be personal assistants, and that in and of itself is not unusual in the slightest. But, you know, like Zoe just said, you know, there are these issues of taking constituent contacts and taking them and putting them into what are basically, you know, political organization database that could be used for other types of outreach, fundraising, calls to action, that sort of stuff. But the key there would be, you know, what was that information going to be used for? Did they actually take, you know, something that was delivered to them in their public function and then turn it to a private, personal, or political function?
So we know the possible actions a House could take would be censure, reprimand, expulsion, or nothing. Rick, what standard is applied in deciding whether to boot someone out of the House of Representatives?
You know, we've heard a lot of different things over the years. You know, it used to be sort of this idea that you had to have been found guilty of a felony involving a violation of the public trust. But the reality is, according to the state constitution, if 2/3 of your fellow lawmakers believe that you are no longer fit to serve and vote that way based on a, you know, on something that's real, that you've got to have a reason that's entered into the record, then you're out.
And
that simple.
What kind of timetable do we have?
Well, what we're all going to be watching now is first thing tomorrow morning, come 9 a.m. in that state house, we have the first meeting of this special House committee that was actually created a couple weeks ago before this report even came out. They will now use this report. It is a committee of 4 Republicans, 2 Democrats. So folks will be watching that, and then we will see. Do lawmakers decide to vote to kick them out, or will we see some type of deal come first? A lot of folks saying, hey, particularly in Representative Gamrat's situation, that maybe she hasn't resigned or stepped down yet because she wants to use the job as a bargaining position, saying, hey, you know, let me quietly, resign, and then I won't face maybe some of these charges that could be severe if there are campaign finance mm-hmm. Issues and violations.
Quite the political soap opera.
It will
opera.
Be something we will continue to watch, and it is certainly not over.
Our It's Just Politics team of Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark keeping an eye on the soap opera in Lansing. Thanks so much, you two.
You bet.
Thanks, Cindy.
For years now, when state leaders talk about school funding challenges, it's virtually inevitable someone will say, well, wait a minute, what about the money from the lottery? Isn't that supposed to fund our schools? It is a persistent misbelief many of us can't quite give up. MLive's Kyle Felcher is here now. And Kyle, I have to tell you, back in 1988, I produced a call-in show for a Detroit TV station with Governor James Blanchard. So we'd take questions from the public, and you could take it to the bank that the most popular question was, well, what about the lottery? Doesn't that support our schools? So this has been hanging around a long time.
It's something that is just as loud today as it was in 1988. Come budget time, and there's a little bit of money not there that people want to be there, and they say, well, what about the lottery? What about the lottery? And it's a question we get asked a lot.
So break it down for us, because you did so in a very, very well done and right to the point video on MLive. So yeah, the profits from the lottery do go to the school aid fund, right?
They do. And to be fair to the lottery, it's not a small amount of money. It's $776 million last year. But the school aid fund budget is so huge that only accounts for 6.5% of the school aid fund budget. The budget as a total is $13.9 billion for the next fiscal year. So $736 million is a lot of money, but it's not really going to make that much of a difference in the grand scheme of things. So that's about 30% of all money from the lottery. Most of the money goes, about 58% of the money that is generated by the lottery goes to prizes. Some goes to other expenses. Some goes to retailers. And 30% of it goes to schools.
That profit.
Not a small amount, but not a lot.
Well, in fact, I love the way you, in the video you produced, you point out, hey, that $776 million sounds pretty big to most of us. You point out you could buy the Red Wings for that amount of money.
Exactly. Not only the Red Wings. I looked at, during this, I looked at a lot of sports franchises. You could buy a lot of teams. You could buy most of the NHL for $776 million, but apparently Michigan schools are way more valuable than any sports franchise, right?
You know, you think about only about 6%. And the rest of the school aid fund comes from where?
Well, most of it comes from sales tax. That would be about $5.5 billion last year. That's about 46% of the school aid fund budget. Another big chunk is from income tax. That's $2.5 billion. That's about 27%. And the other third big chunk of it is from the, as I said in the video, the aptly named education tax, which is 15.5% of the budget. So those are the three big chunks. There's some other slivers that account for between 4 and 1%, and then you have your 6.5% from the lottery.
What do you think is behind the fact that this myth, because it really is a myth, that the lottery will take care of the schools, why is that so persistent?
You know, I think it's just how popular it is. You see the lottery, you see ads on TV, you see billboards, you hear radio spots. You know, so you hear about the lottery a lot, and you know, a lot of people know people who play the lottery and spend a lot of money on the lottery. So you have to think that that money goes somewhere, and because you, you know, because of the popularity of it and the fact that the law says all profits must go to the school aid fund, people see all that money being spent and assume that that money is enough to fund a good chunk of, you know, what we spend on students. And it's not a small chunk, but it's not exactly as big as, you know, say, income tax or sales tax.
So the bottom line is, yes, the profits from the lottery do go to fund the schools, but it is a little sliver of the pie.
Exactly. As I pointed out in the video, since 1973, when the lottery was instituted, it's generated $19.5 billion for schools in that time since 1973. That would be a little bit more than what we spend on schools in 1 year.
Good perspective check. It's worth checking out at MLive.com, MLive's Kyle Felcher and his creative and really informative quick video that will take care of that misbelief that the lottery totally funds our schools, because it really, really doesn't. Kyle Felcher, thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside today.
Thanks for your time.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Collaborative, part of the community.
The next idea.
You need to be awake and take actions to make sure the things that matter to you and the impacts that you want to see in the world actually happen. And I feel like a lot of people don't do that.
Just what does it mean to be civically engaged? Well, the answer you give could be very different depending upon your age. Baby boomers may think of the Peace Corps. Millennials may have a different perspective. And our latest contributor to The Next Idea offers some thoughts from that point of view. Chelsea Martin is the Civic Engagement Manager for the Michigan Nonprofit Association, and she's an ambassador for the Franklin Project. Good to have you with us, Chelsea.
It's great to be here.
There are a number of national organizations that have been offering year-long volunteer opportunities for quite a while now. You know, as a baby boomer, I absolutely remember AmeriCorps and VISTA. We said we have the National Civilian Conservation Corps. How does it usually work?
So it usually works by a federal entity called the Corporation for National and Community Service offering funding to entities like state commissions. We have one here in Michigan called the Michigan Community Service Commission. And what they do is they administer AmeriCorps grants to nonprofits throughout our state so that they can then host AmeriCorps members in their community to meet some of our biggest community challenges.
And you were a service year volunteer through the VISTA program. Tell us about that. What'd you do?
I absolutely was. I actually served with the Michigan Community Service Commission as an AmeriCorps VISTA. It was excellent to see all of the work that's happening across the state and help build a civic infrastructure. So trying to cultivate opportunities for other Michiganders to be able to serve in their communities.
And then when you finished that service year, what happened? Did you feel ready for the job market?
I absolutely did. It was excellent career prep. It's really what took me to Michigan Nonprofit Association, where I've supported nonprofits throughout the state for the past handful of years. I also got an education award that helped me pay off my student loans. I'm a proud Eastern Michigan University graduate, and it was just an excellent career prep experience.
And in your essay for The Next Idea, you make some really interesting points, Chelsea, and you note that for millennials, more millennials say helping others in need is more important to them than having a high-paying career.
Yeah, that's so true. And not only are millennials and younger generations demanding those engagement experiences, but they're really requesting that the places they spend their money, so businesses, that they have a triple bottom line. They're expecting that their employers are offering them paid volunteer time and that their employers are civically minded, have a lot of social responsibility. So across the board, we're seeing these younger generations that are demanding that in every component of their life. Volunteerism is no longer just an add-on that you do in your free time. They want it everywhere they go.
And you point out in your essay there is certainly that rising demand, not just here in Michigan, but nationally for more service-year opportunities. We had 500,000 applications received nationally and more than 11,000 volunteers in Michigan. But you say there were more people who wanted to participate than there were available opportunities. That's a pretty good problem to have.
It's a great problem to have, and we really need to look at how we scale those service year opportunities going forward. I'm a firm believer that that's going to take investment outside of the federal government. We're going to need to turn to our business leaders and our philanthropic community in order to raise the capital that it takes to expand those. It's a huge problem to have. It's a great problem to have.
And what do you think is going on, Chelsea? Why is there so much interest?
I think that people are desperate for that connection to community. I think that the way that we engage is really changing. And like I said, people want to have those integrated opportunities, service years, so the opportunity for 18 to 28-year-olds to give a full-time year of service back to their community is a great way to do that. And it just really, it allows people to connect back and feel as though they're helping make change in their communities. We know there are a lot of issues, and people see those. They're not always sure how to solve them, but service years are a great solution.
And there is a national effort at the Aspen Institute called the Franklin Project, and it's working to make a service year pretty much a rite of passage for all Americans. And you're one of the project ambassadors for Michigan. What do you mean by the big idea?
The big idea is really that every 18 to 28-year-old will have the opportunity to serve a year if they so choose. So just like we often ask people, where did you graduate from college, it will be a cultural norm for us to say, where did you serve? And that's really the big idea.
And the idea then can lead to win-win for everybody, right? The community gets help with challenges it's facing, but the young volunteers are getting a lot too.
They're getting that workforce readiness. They're learning professional development skills. Often if they're doing direct service, they're learning very tangible skills. So they may be able to be great mentors. They might be able to help with our conservation efforts across the state. In addition to that, they're receiving support to pay off their student loans. Most positions do offer an education award after successful completion of the service term. And we know that we have a student loan crisis pending in this country, and this might just be one way to help address that.
How is this effort playing out in our state?
Flint is really just a great case study for what this can do. We know that Flint is one of our more struggling cities, but they have been able to leverage national service into their city service plan. And some of the examples are the Community Schools Corps. So they are mobilizing AmeriCorps members in order to offer wraparound services, not only for students, but also their families, to put the neighborhood at the center of schools. And they also have replicated a model that was started by Wayne State University called the Urban Safety Corps. And that has AmeriCorps members placed with university police officers to do community policing, blight eradication.
And how does what's happening in Flint compare with what's happening nationally?
Flint is definitely a leader. They have something called the National Service Accelerator, which their philanthropic community in the city of Flint put up a significant amount of money that's pretty much creating the catalyst for those members to be placed in for their National Service Corps to scale. So actually we have other communities throughout the country that are turning to look to Flint to see how they're doing that so that they can then in turn do that in their communities.
And you tell us that what's happening in Flint can be happening across the entire state of Michigan. What has to happen to make that a reality?
So myself and other leaders in this service field are meeting with businesses, the business community, our philanthropic leaders, and our municipalities to say, how can we take what's happening in Flint and how can other cities around the state implement those same types of strategies? So, you know, we know that Grand Rapids has had some flooding issues. Maybe they want to leverage NCCC members to try and help with that infrastructure, or maybe they want to implement a reading corps where they're helping people, helping young students read varied by grade level, by third grade. So there's lots of different opportunities.
And what will it take? What will it actually take, you know, that idea of boots on the ground? Who has to pitch in and what do they have to contribute?
So we're really going to be turning to our business leaders and our philanthropic community to offer the financial resources that it takes to scale these service opportunities. And then we'll be turning to nonprofits to say, are you ready? And we know that you're doing this work. We know that you need the additional capacity of the boots on the ground. So if we can match the nonprofit capacity with the funding support from the business and philanthropic community, we really have the opportunity to scale this throughout our state.
What kind of financial requirements? What kind of money might be needed?
So I can't give you an exact dollar amount, but I can tell you that the average cost of an AmeriCorps member, just their stipend alone, is around $11,000 a year. So if we're looking to scale that, we're looking at $11,000 to $20,000 a year for each member. And then we also try, a good practice is offering technical assistance to the nonprofits that house those members so that they know how to leverage them, how to have them track their outcomes, and how they can be particularly effective in community.
If this idea of this rite of passage, this year of being involved in somehow in a service year, if that's successful, Chelsea, what does your vision look like 10 years from now?
My vision really is that you can ask any young person, where did you serve? How did you serve? And it's just going to be commonplace that people are saying, I'm an AmeriCorps alum. I'm an AmeriCorps Vista alum. I served with NCCC. I did great work with City Year. And that's just part of our cultural dialogue across this country, not just in the state of Michigan.
Chelsea Martin is the Civic Engagement Manager for the Michigan Nonprofit Association, and she's an ambassador for the Franklin Project. You can find her essay on the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. And as always, we welcome your comments and your thoughts there or on Facebook or Twitter at Next Idea MI. Chelsea, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
If you count yourself among those who just can't imagine life without your faithful dog curled up next to you each evening, you would have been a pretty rare breed just a century or so ago. That's when packs of feral dogs were roaming the streets of Detroit. People lived in fear of rabies, and the dog catcher prowled the streets scooping up all those strays. And then there was the flip side, the wealthy. Before we had Paris Hilton carting her Chihuahua Tinkerbell all over the world, the wealthy of 19th and early 20th century Michigan were pampering their pooches in the most outlandish ways. Bill Loomis has tracked the history of dogs in Detroit for the Detroit News. Always good to have him in the program, Bill.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, as Detroit's human population continued to grow through the 1800s, it certainly seems from your story the canine population was doing exactly the same thing. How big was the stray dog problem?
It was a serious problem. It was not just in Detroit. It was across the country. And you're right. As people grew, the dogs grew, and they couldn't control them. It was much like rats. They were out of people's control. About almost every year, they would have a proclamation, have the marshal try to shoot the dogs or try to control them somehow. It was especially bad in the summertime.
Well, as you get into the 19th and 20th centuries, we found out in your piece, people were worried about rabies. And I think all of us who read and watched To Kill a Mockingbird remember the scene with the rabid, the mad dog, and Atticus popped up his glasses and took aim and took out the dog.
Right, right. I think didn't that happen with Old Yeller, too, or something like that? Right.
So the fear we kind of forget about rabies.
Oh, yeah, no. They used to call it hydrophobia. And it was a really dangerous situation because the dogs would bite kids, of course, and people in general would just run at the sight of a mad dog. In fact, there was a season in Detroit in the end of the summer called Mad Dog Season. That's what they referred to it. And people believed actually that rabies would only occur in the summer, that the dogs weren't rabid in the winter. But really that was attributed because there weren't as many dogs on the street. So they didn't have as many reported rabies cases. But yeah, it was just awful, awful. And there was over 90% chance that you would die if you had rabies.
So it was a legitimate fear.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the press did not help things very much, did they? You have a headline you dug up, and I'm going to read it verbatim. Policeman fights mad dog in darkened cellar. Thrilling encounter with a brute. Children bitten. Really?
Yeah, that was a pretty common headline. And that was a lot of the reason why some people said rabies was just a made-up disease. They didn't believe it was actually a real thing. Especially dog fanciers, people that bred dogs and stuff. They said, oh, this is all just bunch of baloney.
Wow. So that was the 1800s into the beginning of the 20th century. But mm-hmm. at the same time, people were worrying about catching rabies from a stray dog. You bring us the pampered dog.
Yeah.
What was it like to be a dog owned by a wealthy Detroiter, say around 1890, 1900?
Right. Life was good. You slept on satin pillows and you ate cream chicken and mushrooms. And there was all these reports of these pampered pooches. And you had footmen that attended to you, and you had, you're given special rides, and it was almost laughable.
Yeah, didn't they have some kind of like dog club where if you were going away, right. The footmen and the maids would take care of your dog?
That's right. They were called kennel maids. They became dog breeders later. They really got to understand dogs, and women became serious dog breeders at the turn of the century.
And that's when things began to turn, where the middle class started viewing dogs as part of the family, and
yeah.
as opposed to the farmers who saw the dog as a working instrument.
Right. Right. Even hunting dogs yeah. weren't pets, but yeah. The dog as a pet really became with the middle class in the late 19th century and up into the 20th century. There wasn't stuff like dog food and things like that. That came later. And dogs really weren't allowed in the house. They slept in dog houses or under the front porch and that kind of thing.
Well, you think of some of those early, early cartoons, in right. which the dog would be
right.
out in his little
right.
dog house.
That's right. And people also seemed to like more aggressive breeds back then as well.
Like what breeds?
Bulldogs were really popular. Pit bulls, bull terriers, they called them. Big Airedales. Big terriers. And I'm not really sure why, but they were frequently listed most popular dog breed of the year would be dogs like that.
That is interesting. And
well, I think it has to do – this is my own supposition, mm-hmm. but there was a more masculine culture back then. And those sorts of characters, that character of a bulldog, relentless and brave was highly prized. It was also the days before lawsuits. And as soon as lawsuits kick in, you don't see dogs biting mailmen so much anymore and that
yeah.
kind of thing.
Okay. And I'm curious, what would be if it, let's say it's 1920, what might I name my dog?
Well, the most popular name was Sport.
Sport.
Yeah. And actually it was around 1912 when I found the list that listed the most popular names. And
okay.
Sport was the first. Other names were Carlo, Jip, Dan, Frank, Fritz, even one called Ding Dong. That was a popular name. Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, who knows indeed. but you also found even as people were bringing dogs into their homes as pets and making them part of the family, you also found people just like today who didn't think twice about dumping a dog who was no
yeah.
longer convenient. You found one story that mm-hmm. quoted a woman saying, I hope someone finds and is good to Dick. He's been such a good dog all summer. What was that?
Yeah, right. Well, people would do that constantly. They would leave dogs up north and if they traveled up north. And in some cases I found they'd abandoned the dog. It was a dog that maybe didn't work out at home. And nowadays we might take that to the Humane Society. Well, they didn't have Humane Society back then. So people, when they'd go up north, well, we'll just leave them in the woods. It was like a classic out of sight, out of mind mentality. And that was done with cats, too. It became a national problem.
Fascinating, fascinating. Just seeing how things changed. And I guess we have come a long way from those big, big packs of dogs that
yeah.
Detroiters in the 1800s had to worry about.
Yeah, well, that started dog catchers. That was in the 1880s when the first dog wagons appeared. And my only knowledge about dog catchers were from the cartoons.
Exactly. The guy with the net.
Yeah, yeah, the bad guy that was always catching the cute little dog.
Yeah.
But that was a characterization that was based on this reality back in the 1880s. The dog catchers were really hated guys. They were – in Detroit, they were part of the police department. in other cities, they were elected officials. And
thus the term, well, you couldn't get elected dog catcher.
Yeah, exactly right.
Which was an insult.
Which was an insult because it wasn't a real good job. I think one of the fellows that ran that was a dog catcher, ran the dog pound, had been bitten 100 times. So not a great job.
Boy, oh boy. Well, it's worth reading. A really interesting story by Bill Loomis. His look at the history of dogs in Detroit is in the Sunday Detroit News. You'll find it at detnews.com. Always love talking history with you, Bill. Thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks a lot, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been a year now since Dr. Mark Schlissel was inducted as the 14th president of the University of Michigan. He took over the job at a pretty tumultuous time. Complaints about high tuition, the university's handling of sexual assaults, and an athletic department under heavy scrutiny. President Mark Schlissel joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks very much, Cynthia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with what tends to be, I think, top of mind for so many people when they think about higher education, and that's the cost. Mm-hmm. Are we at a crisis point, do you think, when it comes to the cost of tuition?
Well, I think higher education is expensive. I think it's enormously valuable. I think there's absolutely no argument that it's not worth what it costs. The thing that I worry about is I think we're obligated, certainly as a public institution like the University of Michigan, to provide access to a Michigan-caliber education for talented people no matter where they fall in the socioeconomic spectrum within our society. So that's the challenge that Mary Sue took on, and certainly is the challenge that I'm continuing pretty aggressively to make sure that a Michigan education is affordable and accessible to people across the full breadth of our economy.
And what would be a solution to keep higher education from being only for a select few?
Sure. So it's really not rocket science. What we try to do is run the university as efficiently as possible so that we can restrain the growth in tuition. However, we need to be competitive for the best faculty, the most robust facilities. So we provide very significant amounts of financial aid based largely on a student's need, calculated in a need-blind kind of way. So we're one of the few public institutions that have need-blind admission for students. So we admit students regardless of their financial need, in-state students. And then we use a formula to calculate what their expected family contribution can be, and then we provide the rest in terms of an outright grant or scholarship, in terms of a work-study job, in terms of a loan. It's very important that our students not who are on financial aid not graduate with loans that really limit their ability to make choices about what they want to do with their life. So we're working hard to increase the fraction of scholarship and decrease the amount of loan in our financial aid package. About 70% of our in-state students get some kind of financial aid. And what most people don't realize is the rate of tuition growth in the last few years at Michigan has been relatively modest, but the rate of cost increase for our aided students has been flat, has been nothing. So the vast majority of students on financial aid, when tuition goes up, we raise their financial aid because we want them to be able to finish their education and go off and be successful and take advantage of all the things Michigan had to offer.
One of the conversations in the state of Michigan centered on the cost of higher education is Republican Governor Rick Snyder calling for more two-year degrees or technical training or community college attendance. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think community colleges and technical degrees are fantastic. So the wonderful thing about higher education in our country is there's all different types of higher education, and students have many different choices based on their aspirations, based on their talents, based on their capacity, based on affordability, to choose whether to pursue a two-year degree, a technical degree, or a university degree. You know, for me, the value of a university degree goes beyond just educating you for a particular first job or profession. It teaches you to be an educated citizen. It gives you a framework from which you can really understand more about the world and have a richer, a psychologically and emotionally richer life. So that's the kind of education Michigan aspires to provide for our students.
You are starting off a brand new school year, meaning a new class of more than 6,000 freshmen out of almost 52,000 applicants, we ought to note. And sexual assault on college campuses is a real fear for students and parents. It's become an issue. In fact, we had headlines this week from across the country. We saw students in Ohio with banners saying things like, "Dads will take it from here," or "Daughter daycare 2.0. As an educator, how does that make you feel?
Well, as both an educator, a university leader, but also a parent, you know, my wife and I have four children, two daughters. Both of them have already graduated from college. But I feel one of my responsibilities as an educator, but certainly as a university president, is to be concerned and to enhance the health and safety of all the students around the campus. And certainly, you're not free to learn and get as much as you can out of college if you feel like you're under threat of assault of any kind. Certainly sexual assault. We take the problem very seriously. As you probably know, we did a very detailed survey of the practices and issues on our own campus. We're using that information to enhance our approach to prevention, to improve the way we support survivors of such episodes. But I want to take care to point out that this isn't a university problem. It's a societal problem. This age cohort of people basically 18 into their 20s and approaching 30, as far as we understand, the incidence of sexual misconduct and sexual assault is not different on college campuses than it is often society at large amongst the same age group of young people. I think it's a cultural problem, and I think we have to have a very broad cultural solution. It's up to us. It's up to the students and this whole generation to say, look, this is not behavior. This isn't my society, and to really police themselves in ways that we can support.
Do you wholeheartedly feel that the university's position to be able to properly investigate allegations of sexual assault and then provide the kind of support that students need?
I think that's something we aspire to do as well as possible. I can tell you at any given moment we're doing it as well as we can, but we recognize that, you know, we're a research and teaching organization. You know, we're not a police state. We're not a judicial system. So we do our very best. We follow mandates that come from the federal government, but we also follow, you know, our hearts and our sense of responsibility as best we can.
Well, U of M was one of the universities identified by the federal government as improperly handling instances of sexual assault. I'm just wondering if you can tell us, where does the investigation stand and how much involvement do you have in it?
Well, you know, we don't know where the investigation stands because, you know, there are perhaps 100 universities that are undergoing scrutiny. One of the wonderful things about being the University of Michigan is when we do something great, the whole world notices. But, you know, we're also a very obvious and prominent target for anybody that wants to make a point. So it's not surprising at all that amongst the 3,000 and something universities in the country, we're amongst the group that are being investigated to make sure that we're doing our job as responsibly as possible. I look forward to hearing the results, and we're in a mode of continuously trying to improve the way we address these issues. But even more importantly, the things we do proactively to diminish the incidence of sexual misconduct on campus.
We're speaking today on Stateside with University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel. When you came here to Ann Arbor, there was a spotlight in a campus-wide conversation on lack of diversity amongst the University of Community. Do you see that? Do you get that lack of diversity that some students feel?
I think it's real. I think it's one of the biggest challenges confronting the University of Michigan, to be honest. I think we cannot achieve the level of excellence in education and research we aspire to without being far more diverse than we are. One big reason why is a lot of learning that goes on at the university is learning amongst and between students. People learn from each other. And I've always found that I learn more from people that look at the same set of issues with a different set of eyes, a different prism, a different set of life experiences. We have to build a learning community that looks more like the society that we serve in order to be truly excellent. And that extends to faculty as well. And there's also really good research that shows that teams working on problems come up with more creative solutions the more diverse the team is. And that argues to me that our research isn't as good as it can be unless the folks we have conducting the research represent the full breadth and robustness of our society.
As president, what's your response and what do you feel that the plan of attack can be, particularly in light of the Supreme Court's decision regarding affirmative action and admissions?
Obviously, we'll follow the law and we'll also pursue what we think it takes to make the university stronger. So I would like every talented student in the state of Michigan to think about applying to the university. We're the public university of the state of Michigan. So I'd like the demographic of our applicant pool to look like the demographic of our state. We need to find ways to identify talented students regardless of their socioeconomic status and the quality of their primary and secondary education. We need to select ones that are going to be successful here at Michigan. We need to go off and recruit our hearts out to make sure they come here and they can see their futures here. We're developing relationships personally as well as our admissions folks with high schools all around the state, particularly in parts of the state that don't send proportionate numbers of students to the U of M. We just announced a fantastic new scholarship program called the Hail Scholarship, like Hail to the Victors. Mm-hmm. It's for high-achieving, low-income students. We're doing it as a pilot. 1,000 students a year for each of the next several years will be invited, based on their grades and test scores and their socioeconomic status, to apply to the University of Michigan. We'll help them with the applications. We'll provide them extra information. We'll give them vouchers so that they don't have to worry about paying for the applications. Lots of help filing their applications. If they can get admitted to the university, then we guarantee them a 4-year full tuition scholarship. So that's $60,000. Plus, if they'll apply, any additional financial aid that they qualify for based on their family's means. So we really want to be proactive in reaching out around the state and make sure that regardless of your circumstances, you've got a shot at getting this world-class education.
Let's pivot over to athletics. Going back a year to when you were new here, you walked into an athletics department that had become, I'd say many would agree, dysfunctional. And you said in your first press conference you were speaking about Brown University, where you've been provost. And here was your quote, "Sports don't permeate the campus. It's just at a different level." I'm wondering what that entire experience from the student rally demanding Dave Brandon be fired to letting him go and bringing on interim AD Jim Hackett and then landing Jim Harbaugh as the new head football coach. How did all of that inform your understanding of the role athletics play at the University of Michigan?
Well, yeah, I think I was misrepresented a bit in that because I came from an Ivy League institution where we're not on national TV playing football every week, the presumption was that I didn't know anything about sports. I didn't care about sports. But, you know, as a kid growing up in America, you're surrounded by sports. You know, I played basketball. I played tennis. I went to baseball games with my dad and football games with my friends. So I've been a sports fan my whole life. So it wasn't as if I came in completely naive, for starters. What I did discover is there's an intensity and a passion and a sort of culture here where athletics, I've heard people describe it, and I think correctly, as some of the connective tissue that holds the community together. So whether you're here on campus as a sophomore or whether you're a faculty member or whether you live in the community – or whether you're an alum who graduated 40 years ago, you care about how the team's doing. You get excited. You want to talk about it with your friends. You live and die with the maize and blue. That level of emotional intensity and the depth of the role in the culture of the university, that I had a see to believe. I mean, I was getting emails and calls from leaders in our society, people in your profession and all around the country, for example, that felt as if they had a personal stake in Michigan athletics. So that was my real learning experience, understanding the cultural role that intercollegiate athletics, particularly football, plays in Michigan.
And you have made some pretty clear statements about your thoughts on the fit between college football and the academic standards at the University of Michigan. And right from the start, you said academics really had to be the focus. So how do you do that when there is this incredibly passionate culture?
So I can tell you, Cynthia, that even the people that are zealous supporters that keep their season tickets even though they graduated 30 years ago and live in California and can't bear to give them up, even those people don't mistake the reason why the university's here. They all know we're here because we're educating the rising generation. We're creating new knowledge. We're the engine of innovation for society. They don't mistake that. They just get excited about sports. So there really isn't an inherent conflict, people know why we're here. People pay an awful lot of attention. So especially with the new coach we hired, who's mm-hmm. such a celebrity in addition to being a spectacular coach, people are drawn to it. It's magnetic.
I'm wondering what was it that made you decide to say yes to the offer of this job, to come to the University of Michigan, to come to the state of Michigan?
Well, it's interesting because I've never lived in the Midwest before. And to my embarrassment, although I had many professional friends who've worked here and I'm very familiar with the scholarly work in my own field in biomedicine that's been gone on here, I'd never visited the university before the search. Several people recommended me for the position and the search firm and the search committee reached out to me. I was the provost at Brown. Being a provost is kind of like being the farm team for presidency. So many, many provosts of my generation are now university presidents. I had only been at Brown for a couple of years. I had no intention of leaving. I had received inquiries for other jobs of this type, and I wasn't interested in any of them. Michigan is one of those things that it's held in such esteem in the world of academics that if an opportunity like that presents itself to be considered for such a thing and you let it pass by, it's the type of thing that you always regret.
So in this year, what's left the biggest impression on you, both in terms of the university community and the state?
Sure. That's a great question. So I think for me, the defining characteristic, the most spectacular thing about the university is its breadth of excellence. So 19 schools and colleges, 100 programs, graduate programs and professional programs in the top 10 in their field. If there's something interesting that humans can study, it's being studied here at Michigan at the highest of levels. So that's our real strength, is our breadth of excellence. I'm also very impressed with the faculty in a way I didn't expect. So we're a great research university. I'm a researcher. My heart's in the my lab. My lab's in the freezer right now. But when I would talk and try to get to know the Michigan faculty, a common question I'd ask them is, what are you excited about? What's coming up this year? What are you looking forward to? And I expected them to tell me about a new grant they got or a book they're publishing or a new piece of equipment for their lab. A lot of the time they told me about a spectacular student they've been mentoring or a new class that they're developing with a colleague from another field. Or a question that a freshman asked them that has puzzled them for weeks and weeks and weeks. So there's a level of commitment to teaching amongst the Michigan faculty that was surprising, refreshing, inspiring for me. The students, you know, you've seen them. You know, they're full of energy. They're incredibly entrepreneurial. They're passionate. They have a real social conscience to them. They're not passive people, and I'm really excited about that. The university is just incredibly well positioned for its next 100 years.
And now you're a Michigander.
And now I'm a Michigander. I traveled all around the state. I tell people how beautiful Lake Michigan is and Lake Superior. And it's just absolutely gorgeous.
President Mark Schlissel, it is a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us on Stateside.
Oh, it's really a pleasure and an honor. I look forward to speaking to you again as well.
And if you miss Stateside on the radio, you can always catch us on iTunes. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And while you're there, please give us a review. We would really like to hear what you think. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and today's engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Ryan Grimes, and Shana Roth. Joe Lindstroth is producer of The Next Idea. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.